Hey, you guys, welcome back to Flickers of Fear. So, I'm sure that I've mentioned once or twice, probably like a million times, on this channel and elsewhere, how much I love made-for-TV horror movies from the 1970s. I'm not entirely sure what it is about them particularly that's like so attractive to me. It might just be that they kind of take me back to my childhood and sort of give me a warm, fuzzy feeling of nostalgia. Or it could be that there's some kind of particular vibe to them that really resonates with me for some reason. I don't really know, but I just really like a lot of them and I just like the whole mood around them, I guess. So when a couple of you guys out there asked me to take a look at 1973's The Norlis Tapes, which was a potential series pilot made for NBC, which I had actually heard of, but I had never seen. I was intrigued enough to be like, okay, that sounds pretty cool. And I actually found it, if you're in the US, at least, I'm not sure about other countries, but if you have the Plex app, you can watch it on there for free with ads, which is where I saw it. Doesn't appear to be streaming elsewhere. Maybe somebody put it someplace else. I'm not really sure, but that's where I found it. So I watched it for free legally with ads. So this movie has quite a pedigree. I was actually quite surprised. It was directed by Dan Curtis, the very famous, you know, Dark Shadows, Trilogy of Terror, Burnt Offerings, all of that stuff. Teleplay by William F. Nolan, who also wrote the screenplay of Burnt Offerings, and he actually wrote or co-wrote the novel that Logan's Run was based on. And it was adapted from a story by a dude named Fred Mustard Stewart, which is, that's a great fucking name, who actually wrote the novel The Mephisto Waltz. Now, I haven't read the novel, but I did remember seeing the movie and liking it, but I'd have to, like, watch it again because I saw it when I was a kid. So, The Norlis Tapes was very clearly NBC's kind of take on the paranormal investigator battling a classic monster formula that had actually been really successful over on rival network ABC when they made the 1972 classic TV film The Night Stalker. Now, that was also produced by Dan Curtis, as was its sequel, The Night Strangler, which actually I believe Dan Curtis directed that as well. So Dan Curtis is all over the networks, like back in the 1970s. Now, The Night Stalker, as most horror fans know, actually the two TV movies were so successful that it spawned a series, which was called Kolchak, The Night Stalker, starring Darren McGavin as this kind of like world-weary detective character who's always fighting like kind of like the monster of the week. And that show is pretty much, I mean, even at the time, it was beloved by many. It actually got really, really good ratings, even though they stuck it in a really shitty time slot. And it still has like a really big cult following to this day, even though it actually ran for less than a season. So The Norlis Tapes was also intended to be a series along the same lines as Kolchak, and it only has minor variations from that formula, like I said. This time around, the paranormal investigator character, David Norlis, was kind of like a journalist, author type guy, played by Roy Thinnes. And the framing device, which I actually quite liked, was a series of tapes about different cases that he looked into while he was working on a book debunking the supernatural. Now, I actually would have loved to see where they went with this, like if it actually went to series, because it's such an intriguing setup. And like I said, I love that framing device, like of the tapes and stuff. But unfortunately, the series wasn't picked up. So all that remains is this just single standalone film, which is actually pretty entertaining in itself. But it is a little frustrating because it ends in a little bit of a cliffhanger that never got resolved. And, you know, obviously will never be resolved because this was 1973 and it was a long time ago. So at the beginning of the story, we're introduced to our main character, David Norlis. And when we first meet him, he's not looking too good. He looks like he's maybe been on a several day bender. He can't manage to button his shirt. Looks like he hasn't cleaned his house in God knows how long. You know, like I said, he's having a rough time. Now he's talking to his publisher, whose name is Sanford Evans, on the phone. And Evans is all, hey, how's that promised book coming along? Evidently, this publishing house gave Norlis like a really big advance a year ago to produce a book exposing kind of like all the fake paranormal shit, like mediums and psychics and, you know, seances and shit like that, that have been going on like in, I'm assuming just in the Bay Area, because this is set in San Francisco. So he's been going around like investigating all of these fake mediums and so forth, and he's supposed to have produced a book about it, you know, and like I said, it was a year ago. Norlis says, well, I got some bad news for you. Got some bad news and some worse news, actually. He's like, bad news is, I haven't even started, like, writing it yet. And he's like, bro, you've had, like, a year. What the fuck have you been doing all this time? He's like, yeah, well, it's not even that. It's just that now I realize that I can't write it. Evans, the publisher, understandably asks him, what the hell do you mean by that? And at this point, Norlis is like, well, I need to talk to you, like, immediately, because tomorrow it might be too late. So Evans is just kind of like, okay, whatever you say, man. And so he says he's going to meet him for lunch, but then Norlis never shows up. And then over the next couple of days, it becomes very clear that Norlis has completely disappeared. So Evans, who is worried about his friend slash investment, I guess they're friends, but, you know, they gave him all this money and they're like, hey, where's the book, bro? So Evans ends up going to Norlis's rather well-appointed Bayside bachelor pad. I was like, wow, there must be like a lot of money in writing books debunking the spiritualist stuff in the 70s, if you can afford a place like that in San Francisco, which was expensive even back then, but you know, I digress. But anyway, so while he's in this, in the bachelor pad, he finds a series of numbered tapes on which Norlis has been recording, I guess, like, his notes for the proposed book. That's what some writers do. They talk into a, you know, recorder, and then they transcribe it later on. So Evans pops in the first tape, and as the tape starts playing back, like Norlis's narration, the movie kind of goes back in time to the case that first made Norlis realize that the supernatural might actually be real and something with which one should not fuck. So that's what he meant when he said, I can't write this book now, because even though, yeah, I was exposing all these fake mediums and there's a lot of fake ones out there, but I discovered there's some real shit to it and now I'm in trouble. You know what I mean? So there's that kind of thing. So we go back to this first case, which, like I said, this is the pilot episode. So they would have had, you know, every week it would have been like a different case, like a different tape. So Norlis gets put in contact with this wealthy widow by the name of Ellen Court, who's actually played by a pre-police woman, Angie Dickinson, so I thought that was kind of cool. Now, she wants him to investigate some possibly paranormal shenanigans involving her recently deceased sculptor husband, James, who's actually played by the renowned stuntman, Nick Dimitri, and you'll figure out why later on, why he's played by a stuntman. So one night, she tells Norlis, her German shepherd, Raleigh, woke her up in the middle of the night, and when she went out to, like, her, they live on this, like, big, huge, massive estate, and so the guy's, like, the husband's studio was kind of, like, in this little converted barn, like, that's some way away from the house. Oh, and by the way, he's also buried on the thing, so I guess you can do that if you're rich enough, I suppose. So, yeah, so the dog barks, so she goes out there to the studio to see, because I think she hears, like, a noise, like, out of the studio or something, she thinks somebody's, like, fucking around out there. So she goes out there to see what's going on. And as she does, her lumbering, blue-skinned, and yellow-eyed husband now attacks her and kills the dog. I mean, it's pretty horrible. Like, basically, like, picks up the dog and, like, flings it. It's not a real dog, obviously, but I hope not. But, yeah, it's still pretty upsetting. Because I'm like, why? Even back in the 70s, they couldn't even leave the puppies alone. God damn it. But, yeah. So, basically, flings the dog aside like a rag doll, which is fucked up. Now, Ellen, you know, she's like, holy shit, and she, you know, shoots the dog-killing son of a bitch, like, right in the middle of the chest, like, point-blank range, right? But then he kind of, like, staggers off, and then when the cops get there, they don't find a body, and there's no blood other than the dog's blood, because, yeah, the dog got killed, the puppy got killed. Now, the dismissive sheriff, played by Claude Akins, because of course he is, he always played the dismissive sheriff in all of these movies, I feel like, he just says, oh, well, what happened, ma'am, was you got woke up in the middle of the night, and there maybe was an intruder in here, and you shot at him, and you missed, and then he ran away. Maybe it was probably just some bum looking for some place to sleep, so, like, don't worry your pretty little head about it, essentially. But Ellen is just trying to tell him, like, dude, it was my husband, like, back from the dead. And so that's why she contacted Norlis, because she's like, hey, you look into all this paranormal shit. I want you to figure out what the fuck's going on. Why is my dead ass husband, like, wandering around? Now, shortly after this, a random young woman who doesn't have anything, like, she really is a random young woman. She's just some woman that works at a store or something. And she's kind of getting off work and going out to her car, like, to go home. And she gets killed when the zombified husband attacks her from the backseat of her car, and then that makes the car, like, crash into a tree. Now, when the cops get there and they take the body out of the wreck, they discover that the woman has actually been completely drained of blood, which, you know, I'm no forensic scientist, but I'm pretty sure that a car accident doesn't do that. So now the sheriff, again, is less dismissive this time, but still a little bit dismissive, but he's very befuddled also. And he basically tells everybody that will listen, yeah, let's keep this little detail on the down low until we get everything sorted out. Don't tell the press. Don't tell. He's like, you can tell him that she was murdered because it's very clear that she was strangled and that all her blood was missing. So that obviously the crash didn't kill her, but he's like, yeah, don't tell him about like all the blood being missing because it's like, yeah, we don't need that like fucking shit show coming down on us while we don't exactly know what's going on. So as the story progresses, it comes to light that before his death, James Court, and this is actually what he ended up dying of, he got some kind of, I don't even think they say what it is in the movie, but he got some kind of like crippling and very like fast acting disease. And while he was declining, he sort of like in desperation turned to the occult in an attempt to stave off death, I guess. Now, through a contact at the gallery that handled his sculptures, so I'm assuming it's just like, it's like the gallery owner, I guess. I don't think it's his agent or anything. He gets introduced to this antique dealer slash medium type lady who's called Mademoiselle Jekyll. I can't remember how they pronounced it. And she's actually played by Vanetta McGee. As soon as she popped up on screen, I'm like, Blackula. She was in Blackula. So I like recognized her right away because I love that movie. So yeah, so she was in this as well. Now, she ended up giving him like some kind of ancient Egyptian scarab ring that James insisted in his will that he be buried with after he dies. So while all of this information is being uncovered, more people, including the gallery owner and Ellen's sister, get killed. Like, they turn up dead. So Ellen and Norlis actually go back into James's studio to see if there's something unusual there that they missed the first time that's maybe going to explain this weird shit that's going on. And when they go in there, they find this sculpture of like a devil-y superhero looking creature guy dude that actually wasn't there a couple days before. And they're sitting here going, hey, like all this clay is still kind of damp. So that means that James, like zombified James, has been toddling out of his coffin at night and working on his sculptures. They do find out too that like, because like I said, the dude is buried like in a vault on the property. And they find out later there's all these like underground tunnels. So he's just popping out the coffin and like going down under the ground and like coming out in his studio and all this other kind of stuff. So it turns out though, that even though he's coming back from the dead to do the sculpture, he's not just doing it for shits and giggles. He's actually like what Mademoiselle Jekyll tells Norlis later on is that undead James actually made a pact with a demon named Sargoth, which I thought was very funny, to sort of make this kick-ass kind of life-size vessel out of clay and human blood, like mixed together. And, you know, the demon is gonna like manifest in this statue, like a golem, I guess. It's kind of like that. And so they're like, if James does that, then he'll get like eternal life. So it's like an exchange deal with the devil kind of deal. So that's why all the victims were found with no blood. James had been kind of using his kills in service of his immortality giving art project. He'd been like draining all their blood somehow. I'm not really sure, because I thought at one point they showed him like drinking it like a vampire. But then I'm like, what? Does he go like spit it back into the, does he just like hold it in his cheeks like a chipmunk? Or I don't really know. I'm thinking too much about it, I'm sure. So this demon, Sargoth. Sorry, that's just a really funny demon name. So the demon actually does manifest briefly in the world. He ends up looking a little bit like, I mean, because it's a TV movie from the 1970s, so the makeup and stuff, prosthetics isn't going to be like the best. So he looks a little bit like rust-colored 1970s Incredible Hulk, with kind of like a Halloween-style devil cape on type of thing. It looked like he also kind of had like tighty whities on too, or like little superhero panties or something. I don't know. I couldn't really tell, like, because I didn't really see him that good when he was like in his human form. I just saw him when he was in his clay and human blood form. So I was just kind of like, okay, that seems like an interesting outfit. Like that's why he kind of like gave me the impression that he was like a superhero. So he does actually like pop out the thing and like, you know, the statue comes to life and everything. But apparently the demon is thwarted by Norlis, like using some kind of magic potion that he made, but also like mixed with fire. Like he makes this kind of circle around the statue and then like with the potion, and then like he lights it on fire and the demon can't get out or something like that. So Because this movie, though, was intended to be the beginning of a series, it's left unstated whether the demon was actually destroyed or sent back or whatever, or whether Sargoth was going to be, like, a recurring baddie, like, as the story continued. So you don't really know. It seems like he got destroyed. Like, they find zombified James's bones in the thing, like, you know, prompting, which I would prompt him to go to the cop and be like, see, I told you, my dead husband was, like, walking around. But they didn't find anything. They didn't find, like, any demon bones. I don't know if demons have bones, whatever. So, like I said, I'm thinking too much about it. So anyway, So I don't really know. I don't really know if he was gonna, like, come back as, like, a recurring, like, ooh, this is, like, the big demon that they're gonna, like, fight at the end. So the film actually ends with the publisher, Evans, popping in the second tape, the second Norlis tape, in which Norlis is going on, you know, hey, chapter two, going on to a new chapter and talking about a different case. But, of course, we'll never find out what that case was gonna be, and we never found out. This was the thing that bothered me, and that it's, like I said, this is, that was, like, a cliffhanger, was that, you know, remember I said at the beginning, like, Norlis had actually, like, disappeared, you know? So you never actually find out, like, where Norlis disappeared to, and if this whatever supernatural underworld or the demon or whatever that he uncovered had something to do with where he went. Like, is he dead? Is somebody keeping him somewhere? Like, so you'll never, like, find out. Because the series, I'm assuming, was going to be his publisher listening to all his tapes, and then at the end, like, in the season finale, I'm assuming they would have found out, like, where he was and, like, gone to rescue him or whatever. But, like I said, you're never gonna know because this was it. Now, I will say, like, the Norlis tapes, it isn't quite as fun as the Night Stalker or the Kolchak series, just because that was, like, funnier. That had, like, a lot more, like, dark humor to it. And this one doesn't have any humor. It's very, it's played very straight. But I will say that it is a very, very effectively creepy kind of slab of 70s made-for-TV goodness, which, like I said, I love all these kind of made-for-TV movies from the 70s. Has very decent acting in it, has some actually, like, some really great suspense, some very well-staged action sequences, and the look of the kind of vampire, zombie, undead dude, you know, it's crude by today's standards, but it's still pretty damn good, and, you know, the stuntman, Nick Dimitri, is very imposing, like, he was a big dude, and he actually, like, provides some really good scares, like, for example, like, when you pull the curtains aside and his creepy ass face is, like, on the other side of the window, or, you know, when he busts through a door unexpectedly, or, like, pops out someone's backseat or something like that. So he is actually, like, very imposing and, like, kind of scary, and the makeup is, like, kind of scary looking, even though, like I said, it's crude by today's standards, but it's the 70s, it's a TV movie, what are you gonna do? So, like I said, it's really a shame that this didn't get picked up as a series, because I really did like that conceit of Norlis and his collection of case tapes, and I really would have liked to see where they went with it and what ended up happening to Norlis, like, where the fuck he went to. But, I mean, at least we got this little movie, and it's, you know, it's pretty fucking good. It's a perfectly satisfying diversion in its own right. It's just a shame, like I said. It's like I said, it's not as good as the Kolchak movies, just because those were, like, funnier and more. So this one was more serious, and Roy Thinnes is not, like, he's kind of a more of a very, like, world where he's not, like, real sardonic or anything. He's just very serious and very weary and stuff like that. But it's along the same lines. So if you like that kind of thing, which, you know, like, later on would go and be, like, the X-Files and stuff like that, this is, like, proto X-Files kind of stuff. You know, what I feel like, you know, all the Kolchak, Night Stalker and all that kind of stuff, any kind of, like, paranormal monster of the week, like, paranormal investigator meets monster of the week kind of thing. So it kind of all started with this kind of thing, and I can see why NBC wanted their own version of the ABC, like, Kolchak stuff, because it was so popular, but unfortunately it just didn't work out. But actually, this is an actually really good 70s TV movie, and I enjoyed it very much. So thanks, you guys, for recommending it. I mean, I probably would have got around to it eventually, but it might have taken a while if you guys probably hadn't brought it up. So I'm glad that I actually got to watch it. So that'll do it for this Flickers of Fear, and I will see you guys again on the next one. Bye.